shame.
You guys were in No Shame?
No, it wasn't. Colors.
What? Is that going on
True
right
colors,
now?
True colors, babe.
Where's No Shame going on right now?
I don't...
Take care of my daughter.
I'm not sure, but it's the atrium.
It's the atrium? We gotta check that out next time, though.
Yeah, we should do that.
Yeah, yeah. Up before. You know, maybe I'll try out my stand-up comedy. Is it? Oh,
is it? Are we still allowed to go in here?
Is it still open?
Yeah, the broad on the right doesn't even know who I am, but she's jumping on the bandwagon. She's been drinking.
So we're standing in the New Zone Gallery, 164 West Broadway. There seems to be an interesting exhibit I see on the far wall. It's called The Never Ending Dance. It looks like an exhibition of photography of, looks like mostly women, in different sorts of dress. There's also a few men involved. There's fairies, there's women in different poses, the eld, the young. It looks like one piece. The model is Kiss Kate, done by Faye Photography. And it's called Waif. And there's this very slender woman in a green dress, a strapless dress. And no, it looks like she got a strap over her back, except one side of her chest is exposed to bare one breast. And on her face is a look of emotive insight, of questing, of looking far into the future, and also a little bit of confusion, a little bit of desperation, a little bit of shock, kind of like a deer in the headlights. I noticed that you said that this piece here, the sculpture, is dope.
Yep.
What about it do you feel sings to you?
Well, the shape of it and the texture of the carving and the placement on the two different pieces of wood, aesthetically.
So what we're looking at is a piece called Bodhisattva. It's by Kathleen Howard Piper. It's cast glass, stone, and wood here at the New Zone. And it looks like very reminiscent of goddess worship and very full-breasted.
She's in a meditation pose, and it's a beautiful stone with lots of depth in the color and beautiful natural wood she's sitting on, and she looks very stoic. And mm-hmm.
Would you put this piece of art inside of your home and admire it?
Yes, it's very beautiful. Mm. Definitely, I would.
Do you mind? Do you mind if I use your names, or would you like to remain anonymous?
I'm Gigi Roots.
Great. I'm Monica.
Thank you so much. So I'm here talking with
Steve Lauricia.
Thank you. Steve Lauricia of the New Zone Art Gallery. And so first, we'll talk about this current exhibit right yet. Could you explain what the New Zone is about, what it's doing, what its purpose is for you?
Sure. The New Zone is a members-run art collective. Been around since 1983-84. And we have about 60 members in our group here. And you're about 3 hours late from our first Friday Art Walk. Right. We had a packed crowd in here.
Great.
So we're just sort of cleaning up right now. But we're a community-run organization here, nonprofit 501c nonprofit organization.
Right.
Like I said, we're really here for the community. One of the few galleries left in town. Not too many galleries left, but we're a thriving gallery because
right.
we are a nonprofit. We get great rent here, and the members have a place to show their work, and
right.
We have a great time at doing what we're doing.
Okay. And so the purpose is to showcase of the New Zone is to showcase the artwork of the members.
Exactly. And we also do it for non-members, too. We have in our hallway, we have our Dominic DeFazio Community Hall, which is usually set up for other nonprofit organizations, schools. We show prison art, other non-members' art. We also have opportunities for artists. We have two open shows a year, open non-juried shows, that they can participate. So it's for the community. It's like a win-win-win situation.
So if someone's interested in becoming a member of the New Zone Gallery, what would the process be?
There's three criterias. One, of course, is a jurying process. You have to fill an application, and the board reviews the work. And those criterias that we look for are the art itself, presentation, and if the artist is willing to participate in the gallery, because it does take participation to run the gallery.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed a lot of visual art here. Do you also do other forms of art, like sound art, etc.?
Well, we've had in the past. We don't do them anymore. We've done raves here. We have music events. We do poetry readings here. We used to have live drawing, video presentations. We do have some, you know, musical art here.
That sounds amazing. Now, could you describe this musical instrument art piece here?
This is steampunk, a piece of art. It's an interactive kinetic piece. It's Rachmaninoff's Discord. It's made from a piano soundboard, and then it's steampunked out with various antique working artifacts from an AM radio and steam gauges, vacuum gauges, a couple of meters here and there, and neon and brass tanks. And place below, we have another artist, Hans de Holsey, who's doing our mural outside, and it's back. Here's Hans right here.
Okay. Hey,
I just wanted to say, this is interesting work. To me, I like to think of it as cyber steampunk.
Cyber steampunk. Could you explain?
I'd like to shorten that to cyber steam, because Steve's work is interactive, it's unique, and I think is cool, but he incorporates new things, and this is just one of his many pieces.
Right.
Have you seen any of his other pieces?
I have not. Could you describe some of his work?
Where's your piece? Is there still a piece at the Apple Store?
Yeah, it's an App Store.
So this is the Mac Store at Valley River Center. So.
Yeah, my Treadle-powered computer is there.
Say it one more time.
A Treadle-powered computer.
What kind of powered?
Treadle power. Oh, it's using a Singer sewing machine, Treadle action to power the
Treadle,
computer.
Treadle, I've actually never heard that term before. That's fascinating. So you can pump it, and it'll actually function from the pumping action.
Yes and no. Okay. Eventually will, but right. It will work off the wall too.
So it's a kind of a concept piece. It's a good concept, yeah.
Kind of building
the old and the new.
Oh yeah, always most of the old. Here's my card right here.
Thank you.
My website's on there. Describes all 10 pieces I've produced since last year.
Thank you.
They're all interactive and kinetic, and the website has excellent images and a good description.
What's the website? Could you tell me?
It's www.steamworksresearchlabs.com.
Thank you so much.
.com. Yep.
And then what is the New Zone's website and contact info?
www.newzonegallery.org.
Great. And so anyone interested in researching the New Zone can check out that website.
Yeah, come by. They can talk with me. I'm the gallery coordinator. Best time to contact me is on Wednesdays and Fridays, 4 to 6. I'm always here.
All right.
Very good. Thank you for coming in. Thank you for your time. Actually, now was a good time because it wasn't so busy today. It was so...
So now I'm going to experiment with playing Rachmaninoff's Discord by Steve Larischia, which is, as Steve described, a melange of interactive tactile instrumentation. So here we go. So I'm still here at the New Zone Gallery, and I'm speaking with...
Hans de Holsey.
One more time.
Hans de Holsey.
Thank you. And we're outside of New Zone, and we're going to view his mural.
Which is in the alley, which could be called Olive...
We're walking around the corner in the alley, and what would you call the alley?
Olive Alley.
Olive Alley. Broadway. Oh my goodness, I'm looking at... how big is this? What's the dimension of it?
It's... almost 3,000 square feet.
3,000 square feet. 3,000
square feet.
And
it's tall. It's what's the height on this? Do you think it's like 30 feet?
Close to it, 28 or something.
Yeah.
And then when I get the whole thing done, I'm hoping for about 4,000 square feet. That should make it, if it's not already, the largest mural in Lane County.
Right.
And maybe Oregon. Right. That's not commercial. That's one man, one mural.
So you painted this entire thing.
One guy did the whole thing.
How long has it taken you to paint this?
7 months so far.
7 months so far. So I would like to hear you describe this piece.
What it is it started out as just a short, a small mural.
And this actually wraps around the whole side of the New Zone building.
Watch out. What the heck is this?
It's like a piece for found art.
I just don't want somebody to run over. And, this is sort of where I start.
Right.
Okay, around the corner. So that makes it 154 feet long.
And does this piece have a name?
The Lord Liebrich New Zone Mural.
The Lord Liebrich New Zone Mural. And what was it you feel like you're
Lord Liebrich Theater.
You're expressing.
This is the owner of the building.
Lord Liebrich Theater is the owner of the building.
Of the owner of the building. And so when I started doing this, I got to one of these sides and I remembered it was Lord Liebrich's building. So this is Double, Toil and Trouble, mm-hmm. Macbeth's Three Witches, Prospero up here from The Tempest. And so there's sort of like a theatrical literary theme through it. Three women, mm-hmm. The Thin Man.
And what type of paint is this?
Yeah, it's all paint. It's all outdoor paint.
Outdoor paint?
So house paint. We have 30 years, kind of shit.
Right.
That's the House of the Dead, Dostoevsky.
Yeah.
Over there, Hounds of War, Dogs of War Unleashed from Shakespeare.
Right.
Moby Dick.
Right.
And, here, we got some light here. So you can sort of see, get an idea from sort of the middle of the...
So
of the block.
As an artist, what is your motivation for expression? What is it that you most try to communicate?
I don't know. Sort of a joy for life.
Right.
I don't know, an immediacy. The way I paint. Mm-hmm. I like to reinforce the postmodernist point of view of a chaos theory. I mean, I don't sketch this out, obviously. Mm-hmm. How do you paint 156 square, foot-long painting?
Right.
And sketch it out?
I totally recommend to everyone listening to check this out. This is great. Come to the New Zone Gallery. Come to the alley around the Lord Liebrich building and check this mural out. It is quite fantastic.
So it started as a small section. I got bigger and bigger, and then I just flew with it. But when I started at one end, the next section is going to relate to whatever I've done. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean by the chaos theory, right. Kind of a postmodernist feel that I don't
very
have
stream
some
of, very,
ideal.
Very stream of consciousness.
Very stream of consciousness, but with certain rules.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Because,
I
do have an
art
degree.
Well, I would say the stream of consciousness sort of follows it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I do have an art degree.
I'm comparing you to James Joyce. I think that's pretty phenomenal.
Joyce.
You don't like Joyce?
No. What's not to like,
Yeah, yeah.
So why Joyce, you can turn the page. If you go back and reread, you can carry it in your pocket. This mural, you have to spend some time with.
Mm-hmm. It's an exploration.
Yeah, painting. Where do you see the Mona Lisa? You got to go to Paris. Mm-hmm. Or you see a reproduction. I know they make great reproductions, blah, blah, blah. But still, you still want to see the real thing.
Oh, of course.
You just want to see it. The first time I saw it, I said, what? It looks like a postage stamp.
It's
small, behind all that glass?
Yeah.
And then you see Guernica when it was at the Modern.
Right.
And you go, whoa, awesome. And you want to get that feeling. But, he didn't, I don't think, he did make some sketches, Picasso did. Hmm. But for me, it's just like, you got to go. A piece of paper to sketch this on would be like 8 feet long. Hmm. And it would be like that. And then... What, I present that to somebody? This is what I'm going to do on your wall? This mm-hmm. is something you got to go with.
Right.
So I started here and boom. Mm. And, I've got some themes there. See the arches?
Right.
Okay, they go through. They give it a unity.
Cool.
And when I'm painting, I work between things. So, what do you think?
I feel like there's, like you said, there's so much to explore. Down here I see some people actually look almost like you're depicting people looking at the mural almost and what's going on inside of it, sort of like a meta-narrative of the observers being observed. And
I
enjoy the tree.
I like that meta-narrative.
Yeah. And, yeah, you definitely feel Day of the Dead with the skull themes kind of being portrayed through the loop of the work. And also I see, I see upside down houses, you know, it seems like, or just buildings coming out in very skewed ways, almost with facial recognition patterns being utilized, with the doors being like the mouth and the windows like the eyes, personifying the our edifices, and different animals and people in repose, and there's a lot of faces, and it really, to me, it depicts a lot of the myriad of our co-created cultural existence, how we all come together and to create what we call society. So you state your name again, please.
Excellent. I love your interpretation.
Could you state your name
very
again?
Very articulate. Very intelligently brought about. Oh. Hans de Hollesy.
Hans de Hollesy. And I have a feeling that this mural will be up here for a very long time. Thank you so much for talking with me, Hans.
Thank you. I love that. I'm glad.
Listen to your life. And in the next moment, when a person with their hurtful behavior triggers inside of you a subconscious moment, so that in your body, the habitual pain you afflict yourself with because the child inside of you does not believe it is worthy of love, say to yourself, little child, I see you. Little child, you are safe. Little child, you are loved. What is Merge Radio? Merge Radio is about the power of radical ideas and communicating those ideas to as many people who are interested in questioning reality as it is offered to us. We do not hold reverence for ideas themselves, only for truth. So let us explore these ideas together, trailblazing the paths of free thinking and removing the chains of rhetoric that have been locked tight around us at birth. Who are we as a society? Why do we act the way we do? Can we dream of a world in which we can choose to be who we want and have real freedom? I say hell motherfucking yes. Humans are empowered with a will to determine their own course. We have that power unless we give it to someone else. So let's take our power and do something so radically free as to think outside of the boxes offered to our young, vulnerable minds at birth. Time to question the validity of our cultures and imagine ourselves becoming truly free together.
School was intended on this continent to be as it had been in northern Germany, a fifth column into the burgeoning libertarian condition where disenfranchised and oppressed groups were clamoring for some kind of seat at the bargaining table. School was to be a surgical incision into which the class-based management theories of England were to be inserted to interdict the liberty traditions. England's multi-layered social class is simply a modern-day representation of Julius Caesar's advice that when you're overwhelmed by the enemy, you divide them and conquer them that way by setting them against each other. The method was to be by infiltration into the minds of children, out of sight of their parents. The well-read here won't be shocked. Theorists from Plato to Rousseau to Frederick of Prussia knew and taught explicitly that if children could be kept childish beyond its term in nature, if they could be cloistered in a society of children without any real responsibility except obedience, if their inner lives could be attenuated by removing the insights of history, literature, philosophy, economics, religion, if the imminence of death and the certainty of pain and loss can be removed from daily consciousness, if the profound reflections on one's own death could be replaced with the trivializing emotions of greed, envy, jealousy, and fear, young people would grow older, but they would never grow up, and a great enduring problem of supervision would be solved. For who can argue against the truth that childish and childlike people are far easier to manage than critically trained, self-reliant ones? And now you're ready to hear the six purposes of modern schooling taken directly from Dr. Inglis's book. The first function of schooling is adjustive. Schools are to establish fixed habits of reaction to authority. That's fixed habits of reaction. Notice that this precludes critical judgment completely. Notice, too, that requiring obedience to stupid orders is a much better test of function one than following sensible orders ever could be. You don't know whether people are reflexively obedient unless they'll march right off the cliff. Second is the diagnostic function. School is to determine each student's proper social role, logging the evidence mathematically and anecdotally on cumulative records. You probably thought that the kid or parents or neighbors or the region circumstances. No, the school is to determine your proper social role and there to fix you in that role mathematically on their cumulative records. Next comes the sorting function. School sorts children by training individuals only so far as their likely destination in the social machine, not one step beyond. Keep in mind, you're not listening to John Gatto. You're listening to the man for whom the honor lecture in education at Harvard is named. The fourth function is conformity. As much as possible, kids are to be made alike. Whatever the background they come from, they're to be made alike. This is not done from any passion for egalitarian ideals, but so that their future behavior will be mathematically predictable in service to market research and government research. Next comes the hygienic function. This one's my favorite. This has nothing to do with individual health, but it has a lot to do with the health of the race, at least as Inglis or Darwin or his first cousin Galton saw it. Hygiene is a polite way of saying that school is expected to accelerate natural selection by tagging the unfit so clearly. That's what all those little humiliations from first grade on, that's what all the posted list of ranked grades are about, so clearly that the unfit will drop from the reproduction sweepstakes, either in despair or because their likely mates will have accepted the school's judgment of them as terminally inferior. And last comes a fancy Latin word, the propaedeutic function. That's a fancy word meaning that a small fraction of lucky kids will quietly be taught how to take over management of this continuing project. Guardians of a population deliberately dumbed down and rendered childlike in order that government and economic life can be managed with a minimum of hassle. It's that low down, nitty gritty, common purpose. not Marx's grand warfare between classes and greedy captains of industry. It's simply so that management will have a minimum of hassles.
Hello, Eugene. I'm sitting in here in Cosmic Pizza with Jean Stacy, and we're going to talk about her work with Sleeps and the homeless situation here in Eugene. Well, first of all, good morning. I'd like to talk to first about Eugene Sleeps. What is Eugene Sleeps, and what is the purpose?
Well, it was formed as a reaction, really, to the fact that the city has not been doing much to help and improve the situation for the folks who are unhoused here. And it's comprised of more people who are unhoused than housed. So it's unhoused folks and their advocates and friends.
Okay. And what is this homeless, what in your heart, in your mind, what is the state of the homeless situation or the unhoused situation in Eugene? What are people going through?
Well, it's really difficult with the weather setting in as it is now. And there's a particular kind of pallor over things because the city has made promises last year that it didn't follow through on. And people have been very hopeful. Opportunity Village would be here, that it would be big, and that many of them would be in it. And it just doesn't exist yet. The city has really stalled on bringing that forth. So there's depression setting in. There's a new kind of determination that I'm seeing, though. People now on the streets feel that things should be more fair. When I first was talking to people this summer, there was more a sense of, oh, this is the way it has to be. This is just the way it is. But now I'm hearing real hope and real determination. And I think as people get together, they start talking to each other, the confidence builds, their knowledge of who else in the community is going to support them, that I think it's becoming a force here in Eugene now.
So what are some statistics on the unhoused? How many people in Eugene are unhoused?
Whenever we talk statistics, I feel like we're talking about zebras or chameleons or something because the numbers are so large. We have over 2,400 people in Eugene that are unhoused. Now, about 800 or 900 of them are in some kind of midterm or short-term shelter. But the only emergency shelter we have is the Mission, which is great but has religious overtones that are difficult for some people. And you also have to be a very social person to be able to deal with the confined quarters and the close proximity of other people. And we have a very small group, 10 families, who get shelter through First Place, which is one of the St. Vincent de Paul's. So that leaves approximately 1,500 people that do not have a roof over their head. And again, you would say, oh, many of them are in vehicles or they're doubled up. This doesn't count the people that are doubled up or staying with family members. It counts the people in vehicles. But I was actually amazed to find out that in Eugene, it's illegal to even sleep in your own car.
I did not know that.
Yes, it is very illegal. And the very first offense, they can give you a $200 fine. And on the second offense, they can give you a $500 fine and remove your vehicle. And you have to, you know, pay to get your vehicle back.
Wow, have we heard any sort of rationale why this is a just law? Why they consider it to be a just law?
Well, the city always buries terms and things, oh, it's for the public safety. But I think it's very hard for you and I and most people to sit here and say it's really dangerous for people if a mother and her three young children are sleeping in a car. It's dangerous for the mother and the three children, but it's certainly not dangerous for the public safety.
Right. And you mentioned Opportunity Village. Could you explain what that project is about and how it's shaping up?
Sure. It's a great project. I'm on the board of that. And its goal is to do a pilot program, which was to start this year. But city staff, it took, I think, 5 different times of the council telling them to look for a site. And we still don't have a site. Hopefully December 10th, they will recommend a site for 30 people to come. And it's going to be a place that people can come and live. But while they're there, they're not in the more patriarchal systems like the other shelters, which play a very important and good role. But many of the people on the streets now do not need to be taken care of. They've taken care of themselves for 20 or 30 years, full-time jobs. It's the economy and the gentrification and the disappearance of housing that has them on the streets. So those folks will be helped to kind of reinvent their lives at Opportunity Village. I don't think anybody thinks the job situation is going to improve anytime soon. We have real unemployment in Eugene around 18%. So there aren't jobs. So what we're trying to do is, how do people change their expectations of their lives? The American dream, you know, is a 3-bedroom house and the bathroom and color TV in every room. And that just isn't going to happen for an awful lot of folks. So how do we...
Nor would it necessarily be what is perhaps best for them.
It's not best for them, and it's certainly not best for the world, for us to continue with these high expectations, material expectations. So what we're hoping is that as they come in there, some of the stigma of being on the street will disappear as they enter what's designed to be a really importantly environmentally conscious community of the future, which will allow people to live in a much more sustainable way by having tiny houses under 100 square feet for an individual, growing their own organic food. They'll actually build their little houses themselves.
At Opportunity Village.
At Opportunity Village, and a lot of folks in the business community are interested in helping them get these small entrepreneurships going. So they're volunteering to come and help. And, you know, this is where most jobs come from, is from small businesses, not from the mega businesses and corporations. So that 3-pronged thing, build your own house, grow your own food, learn how to start your own business, are what make Opportunity Village far more than a shelter.
Right, it seems to actually offer them, dare I say, opportunity.
Exactly, hence the word. One of the things people always wonder about, what's the exit plan? Because you get 30 people in their tiny houses, being very self-sufficient. What's next? You know, are they going to stay there forever? And what we're trying to do is develop the houses so that they can be moved out into neighborhoods, into people's backyards. You'll remember that through the Occupy movement, a lot of people who were unhoused became friends with, got jobs with, people they networked with through the community and through the Occupy. So we want the same thing to happen at Opportunity Village, those relationships to form. And so some will go into people's backyards, hopefully as a permanent solution, because HUD housing has, you know, 3 to 10 year waits depending on the color of your skin, your age, your marital status. What the other option is start more intentional communities that will be a lot that would normally perhaps have, you know, 10 or 20 apartments would have 10 or 20 tiny houses. So the environmental impact is, you know, 3%. Of what it would be. People now don't have to hold 2 or 3 jobs to pay their rent. They can actually work part-time, which is all that's available, or they can make enough out of this little tiny business that they're starting that they can really lead a decent life that they can be proud of.
It also seems to me that there is even more opportunity in entrepreneurship reacting to what the market is looking for. If you're going to even take a look at our market situation, you know, as often conservative think tanks do, that it stands to reason that if there are no jobs available, you know, there are other demands in society that need to be supplied, and therefore starting a small business seems like a really great way to break out of a wage slave situation. And not necessarily being dependent on big companies, but forming partnerships and just producing a good.
The really big companies, as you know better than I, are all moving overseas, or the unemployment is so high that they're actually able now to hire people for far less, which was not enough, than they could before. So entrepreneurships and this whole idea of exchange, of people doing for each other. I'm seeing, I know I spend probably 40 to 50 hours a week just working to work on other people's projects, my own projects. There's never any cash exchanged. There's never any taxes paid either, of course. But it's very important, I think, that we, now that the United States right now, there is no way to interface with government successfully. So we really all have to rely on each other. And I think that has been one of the things that's been most exciting to me to find is new people that we can deal one-to-one. I'm not filling out forms or having to go buy something expensive. I can say to somebody, do you have something that I can borrow because it's a one-time use? And so this whole idea of sharing, time, sharing commodities, gets us out of the huge trash pile, the huge need to have a big job that is not available. It just solves a lot of problems. And I think more importantly than anything, it aims us towards preparing for a future that's coming, whether anybody wants it to or not. I happen to want it to come, but a lot of people don't. But some of us are going to be more prepared for other. When I first met Finn Poe, he started describing people who are unhoused as the pioneers of the future. Low carbon footprint, highly creative, able to make do, thinking about materialism in a totally different way. And I have to say I agree with him. I think there's going to be a lot that's learned through folks who are already doing with less. And it's got kind of an exciting future.
And next Monday, they will be, or I should say this Monday, you're organizing an action at Free Speech Plaza. Could you tell us the details about it, the date, the time, and also the purpose?
Sure. It's December 10th, Monday, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We're going to be pitching tents in Free Speech Plaza. We're going there, one, because it is one of the most important protest sites in Oregon, and secondly, because the city council, since it's been unable to decide over the last 2 years what to do with the seismically unsound city hall, was first meeting in the library and is now meeting in the county courthouse, and that's right above Free Speech Plaza. So as the counselors come to work, they will see that the folks who are unhoused now are finding their voice and will be in the plaza. We demanded 2 weeks ago a lifting of 4.815, which is the municipal code that says people can be ticketed this 200, whether in their vehicle or anywhere there's any bedding at all, $200. The mayor, under 4.815, has the right, the authority, to lift the camping ban, to say it's an emergency, we're going to lift the camping ban. At a work session about 3 weeks ago, she said this is an emergency situation when she was talking about the homeless and the winter coming. I think she said it about seven times. So in my mind, she's already declared it an emergency, so that all that's left is to lift the camping ban. So we'll be addressing the council again. We've sent them a formal request to put it on the agenda. I don't believe they have. They found that the best thing to do to make the homeless go away is either ignore their needs or actually chase them away through policing. And it's been very effective in Eugene. So this is what they're still doing, and this is why we have to demand that the protest camp will stay until they lift the camping ban and create designated campgrounds. You know very well that those who are homeless are pushed now. They're pushed to the riverbanks. They're pushed into the wetlands, which are supposed to be protected lands. And then people complain because they're in the wetlands. Well, they're in the wetlands because the city won't allow them to stay in dry land. So if it's an easy-to-police area, there are no homeless people camping or sleeping. And that's what we've got to have change. There are no bathrooms out there. We've got hepatitis C and whooping cough coming down.
Wait. Did you just say hepatitis C and whooping cough in the wetlands?
They're not specifically in the wetlands, but spreading through Washington and Oregon. And they're spread through fecal material. And we've got 1,500 people out there with no bathrooms. The downtown only has three bathrooms. I know four of the last five Sundays those bathrooms were locked. And about 40 to 50% of the time when we've been monitoring them, they've been locked, which means 24 hours a day, homeless people, or people with children or older people who need to go to the bathroom often, cannot go to the bathroom in Eugene. So naturally, those who are unhoused have to use the bushes. This is a public safety hazard. For a city not to provide bathrooms is a public safety hazard.
Yeah, I remember one city council meeting. I think it was it Susie Arlupe who suggested we might have to have a shit-in.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly been talked about, and it's deserving. We all love the Saturday market, and they rent 3 toilets to put up every Saturday. Right there in the center of where those who are unhoused congregate. Well, Saturday night, those outhouses are locked, and they're not unlocked again until the next Saturday morning. So even though they're sitting there, they're paid for, they're locked so that no unhoused people can use them. Now the city just made a proposal to provide the Occupy Medical program with a toilet on Sundays. Now, to rent a toilet is $120 a month, okay? What they're going to do is they're going to rent it 4 separate times in a single month because they're going to have it delivered on a Sunday morning and picked up on a Sunday night, so it won't be there all week for people to use. That's a whole month delivery. If you only use it one day, it's a month delivery. So they proposed a budget to the council of $500 a month instead of $120 a month, just so that they could remove the toilet during the week. Does that make you want to cry?
Efficiency in governance, you have to love it. Now, we were talking briefly before about the idea of healing the heart and what it means. Taking a different sort of viewpoint at homelessness, this divisive us against them, which seems to come from, you know, the news media machine, be afraid of everyone who's not, you know, in your house, for instance, don't, you know, the compelling people not to necessarily go out and meet their neighbors, etc., and that being the level of inclusiveness and how those who are unhoused are because of it dehumanized, and when you are dehumanized, you are considered less than, you're another, as opposed to being part of the greater human population. And I was hoping you might be able to say something on the healing of the heart, as well as some of the myths that are popular help to dehumanize individuals who are unhoused.
I have a friend up in Portland, Ibrahim Mubarak, who is part of the Right to Dream 2 movement and part of Dignity Village. And he says the first thing he always does is tell folks that he's homeless. He's just lost his house. He hasn't lost his heart. And I think that has struck a lot of people as a very poignant statement, because these are people's brothers, sisters, cousins, mothers, fathers, even our own counselors. One of them was homeless. 2 of them have had homeless children. I mean, these are people we know. How we have managed to detach ourselves from that and literally treat them like animals. The city council allocated $100,000 when Occupy is closed to provide shelter for those who are unhoused through the winter. It didn't happen, and this summer that money was pulled out of the homeless shelter for people and given to a homeless shelter for animals. I mean, it's right there at the table. So how does this make those who are unhoused feel? Unfortunately, I think it should just make them mad as hell. But what it does is it makes them feel as if they're not worthy. They quickly get into a pattern of seeing society as right, and they have failed their own expectations. They've failed society's expectations. And that's why when we talked earlier about changing expectations so that you can be successful, you can meet your goals, why it's so important. It is extremely painful. People throw cupcakes at people who are unhoused when they're sleeping in the driveway. They kick them. They pee on them. They are at risk every night of something bad happening.
Well, through exposure, for instance, of being hassled by policemen who are there to, I mean, at least maybe it's just in my imagination, to protect the people who are living in the city.
You know, one of the things that makes me maddest about this council's approach to things is what it does to our policemen. We do have some very, very good policemen in Eugene, a good police force, but the council has given them the job of persecuting the homeless. They've made up these ridiculous laws like criminal trespass, where if you touch a building or you sit on a sidewalk, you are criminally trespassing. You can be arrested, you can be fined $200, which means now you don't have the rent money anymore if you were saving. They're locking people onto the street. There are studies that show if you take one group of people and ask them to be in charge of and in a power position over other people, it's the famous prison experiment.
Lombardo. Yeah, that was Mr. Lombardo. I think he was at Berkeley. Yeah.
Yes, and they found out that the evenly distributed college students, the ones who were the guards at the prison, became so cruel that they had to stop the experiment. So I feel we're taking some really good people who are on our police force and making them really bad, because some of them are doing things that are not okay with those who are homeless. So I'm angry that we're taking a police force that's designed to protect and turning them into a force that's designed to persecute certain people.
And I'm thinking that there might be some good advice for individuals who are housed, to be able to get beyond the sense of separation, even upon just walking, you know, in town. You know, there's the exclusion zone that's a little watered down, but still very much there, downtown, and sort of that reflects this mentality of dehumanization and separation. I mean, What would you suggest is to just someone, you know, walking by someone who seems unhoused or noticing someone unhoused, to help them at least feel like they're safe, you know, because it feels like once the safety trigger is the lever of the rhetoric in the news media that just, well, you're not safe, so listen to what we have to say in order to be safe, kind of thing. Like, how would you help people just to let go of that fear?
And I think you hit it. It's the person themselves having to let go of the fear. For myself, I mean, I'm subject to everything everybody else is subject to in the United States, except I turned off my TV about 20 years ago. But I know I also had a very uneasy feeling when I would come across someone who was very stereotypically homeless. And sometimes I do, because there are some people who are unhoused, just as there are many people who are housed, that you're not safe around. But what I started doing was quite accidental. I walk my dog every morning, and I walk through Monroe Park, which has many people in it who are unhoused. And I just said, good morning. Just good morning. And little conversations. The first morning is nothing but good morning. The next, good morning, how are you doing today? Oh, your dog certainly is pretty. And the people, you make eye contact. You talk to people, you smile instead of looking afraid. You know, that's the beginning of establishing relationships. And when people become people to each other instead of stereotypes, so many of the people on the street are really very, very intelligent. They're just like house people, but something has happened, not necessarily even a bad decision. Maybe they worked for a company that wasn't well managed. I talked to a woman, her son had schizophrenia. She could afford an apartment, but nobody would rent to her. And when she was outside, her son did not have as many problems because he wasn't confined and because we wasn't getting all the negative feedback. So there are a lot of reason people. Another woman that I know, so many women in their late 50s are out on the street right now, health problems. Husband died of cancer, but before he died, all of the family resources were taken away. Foreclosure, bought a house, $30,000 underwater, can't make the payment, you know. So the folks out there are real people just like us. So many of us can say, they're but four, go I. So that's the most important thing. is just eye contact and a smile. You'll either get great feedback or you'll say no. Just like my neighbor three doors down, I don't want to talk to this person.
Yeah, it's amazing, but because of the way the stereotypes have formed up, we're in retraining of how to be more human.
Be more human and to accept differences. I feel like the United States right now is caught in its teens. I don't know about you, but in our teen years, we had to have the little Capizio shoes and the white Peter Pan collars and the button down. You had to have a certain brand on your hip pocket. I mean, this is America where we're taught to conform. And we have on the folks people who have either, some cases, chosen not to conform, and in other cases can't conform. They don't have the resources to conform. And I think that's part of what scares us, is they're different. If they're different, do I know how to handle them anymore? Like, I personally have difficulty being around people that are really drunk, because I can't predict. I don't know what's going to happen, so I don't know what my reaction is going to be. And I think a lot of people take that and assign that to anybody that just looks slightly different. And it creates fear. We're a fear nation.
Well, it's interesting. There's a really excellent book, very, very nice read. It's called Why We Hate. And it actually takes an evolutionary psychology approach to this concept. Of course, there are other approaches. This is just one approach. And it talks about the lower brain, the lizard brain, and how in the wild, human beings at that state of the physical manifestation, they had to sort of make quick, visceral judgments. And it seems like as we developed more of the frontal lobe and upwards, that the rational side of things, and also, you know, there's other parts of the heart, because the heart knows a few seconds or, you know, before the mind does. And it's like when we say healing the heart and reconnecting to reason, it feels like it's a wonderful balancing, because pure reason without heart pretty much gets... It turns into pragmaticism and utilitarianism that you see rampant in the U.S., where the value of anything or any person is what use they produce in some way, and the use is defined in a capitalistic system, and so by money. And then, so pulling back, you know, it's interesting to me that I feel like, I know that people, at least I've been around Eugene and hang around, it's like we get this feeling, and even across the world with the Occupy movements, the global movements, saying no, there's nothing wrong with free speech, there's nothing wrong with helping people who are homeless, even though sometimes in some states feeding homeless people is illegal, you know. So the healing of the heart and mind, whereas in dealing with something of someone that is a social responsibility, it's necessary, because we are more than just the individual nuclear family, genetic material, biological containment systems of the three-bedroom house with a white picket fence, you know what I mean? We're more than that. We are a greater human community. So I really thank you for talking with me today, Gene. And to close out, could you, if someone wanted to, say, help out or volunteer or with Sleeps or any of the Opportunity Village initiatives, if you could give some contact information or you know, how people can help out.
If they would just get on the internet and call and go to the website www.eugenesleeps.org, they'll get to us. We will be happy to forward any request about Opportunity Village onto them as well, or any other organization. But it's really important just to take that step. They can also write us at contact@eugenesleep.org, and we will put them on our email list to know when we're doing events. They can choose to either come and pitch a tent and form some of our constitutional camps, or they can stand in a circle of conscience around us and provide a moral stronghold from which we can be doing the camps, who will test all of Eugene's illegal laws, which are very contrary to the Constitution, to our American way of life, to our values. So they can go the whole protest and stand in determination with their tent, or they can form a vigil around us when we're on these actions. So we'll send them action alerts once they get registered by sending into contact.
So thank you so much for talking to me today.
I enjoyed it very much, as always.
And this is 98.5 KHAC Merge Radio. Hello, Eugene. It is December 7th, 2012. And I'm here with my partner in Hearts and Crime, Helen Being. Say hello to everyone.
Hey, everyone.
She has a sexy voice. Anyway, so we are here at... Where, what's the address again?
We are at 1040 Tyen Street, number 3. We are at the Blunt Graphics Studio, about to attend the Blunt Fink event with the collection of various local artists and musicians.
This looks like an interesting collective. We're standing outside. We can hear the music coming through. It sounds fascinating. And more to come as we venture forth. And for the record, Helen, could you tell everyone what you are currently dressed in?
I'm wearing a kigurumi, which is a one-piece Japanese, very warm, comfy costume. And I am dressed as a traditional Shinto guardian lion that protects the Shinto shrines.
And I have to tell you, audience, this is it's a wonderful swirl of green and green base, very fuzzy. It's got white curled patterns. And it looks very warm, and of course it's got this red lion head with yellow teeth. Do your Tyrannosaurus Rex arms and make yeah, it's amazingly ferocious. It's the barrier of protection and destruction in front of the Shinto shrines.
I'm guarding off evil spirits.
Wait, say it again?
I'm warding off evil spirits.
Fantastic. I thank you for your stalwartness. I'm going to give a little reflection on the art here. Helen, why don't you go first?
Well, I really liked the Lolita parody, where there's an alien, seemingly a monster, green monster, with his reptilian tongue wrapped around the lollipop, and he has the heart sunglasses down over his nose. He's looking over at, and he's looking pretty grotesque and hilariously disgusting.
That seems to be one of the themes here tonight at Blunt Graphics. Hilariously disgusting.
And grotesque, grotesque, definitely. Yeah. But a lot of some of the movie posters that they parodied are already kind of grotesque. There was a Ghostbusters one, there was something from Aliens. But this is, Lolita is this young seductress, and the poster is this kind of innocent but sexual...
Young, being about 14-year-old in the novel.
And
What an archetype it is, too, isn't it?
It's a
really awesome expression, yeah.
Inappropriate, pretty sad story, really, of of a young woman using her sexuality, abusing her sexuality to control others. And I like the depiction of Lolita as a disgusting alien.
Right on.
I find it very visually pleasing with the bold colors and bold, thick lines. I guess that comes, as I said, from the silk screening process.
Yeah, that silk screening process was cool. And the surf music really, really helped out with it. We should find out what that band name is, but I think it's on
the
drums.
They are the Egotones.
The Egotones, yeah, they're pretty damn cool. Yeah.
Yeah, they're really cool. They have some nice 60s leisure suits on, except the drummer is dressed in the Lucha Libre mask.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. It's kind of harkening. I mean, I guess, what's his name? Jack Black made that really popular again in his movie. What was that called?
Nacho Libre is the name of the movie.
Yeah,
I think
La
it's
Lucha
a fun
Libre.
Aesthetic that started coming back, you know, just before Jack Black created that movie, but he certainly helped, yeah.
Right. Cool. Well, this is Argus and Helen Being signing off from Blunt Frink, the Blunt Graphics art show. And this is 98.5 KHAC Merge Radio. So back out here and talking to a patron at the Blunt Frink art show to get some impressions. What do you think of the show?
Impressive. For sure. I like the, just about all of the pieces are in the theme, except one is not quite as holds to the theme.
So what would the theme, what do you consider the theme to be?
Muscle cars, very detailed, squiggly art, and blood, gore, eyeballs popping out. You know, it's kind of a fun theme because it's not all boobs and ass. It's more of like a little bit more muscle car, right. Smoke.
I sense a bit of a punk aesthetic to it too. Not totally there, but there's definitely a feeling of it. What do you think?
Yeah, I think like Stanley Mouse like kind of started this
so
type.
So who's Stanley Mouse?
He's an old 60s poster artist.
Right. What is he most famous for instance? What kind of images?
He kind of took like what R. Crumb was doing and then like inserted the muscle cars, like the badass, like right. I'm going to tear some shit up.
Right, kinda. But the muscle car seems kind of be like a metaphor, doesn't it? What do you think? Of badassery in general?
It could be. Right. It could be. You know, a lot of things are... I mean, that's with art. You know, right. A lot of it is in the interpretation.
Right.
You know, to make a really good piece, like, you keep it open a little bit so right. that people from different perspectives can take something away from it.
And what do you feel like is the role of art in society? Is it important? What does it do?
It gives lazy people a job. No.
So are you saying that there's not work involved in the creation of art and the finding a discipline?
I only
art?
Say that because the other day I was talking, referring to myself as a freelancer and accidentally said freeloader.
Right. Oh, I see. So I guess the assumption here is that art doesn't necessarily function within a capitalistic system as well as other things such as mercantilism. And is mercantilism in capitalism the ultimate judgment in how we determine how something is useful?
I think it's an industry that's set aside so people.
And then you said industry now.
Yeah. Because you know people are intentionally hypocritical.
Oh, how so? That's interesting. You know, where do you see the hypocrisy?
I'm in the commercial arts.
Okay. And, graphic design and such?
Yeah. So it's...
So graphic design for companies who are desiring logos and web graphics and such.
You know, it's usually looked at differently, like a bunch of whores, like making right. art for whoever...
Would you still consider
will
that
...will pay them. Yeah. And this is, you know, it... Regardless of, you know, when you're making something and you're taking in consideration the viewer...
Right.
Whether you get paid or not for it, you're still selling yourself out a little bit, and that's okay. Like I mean, I'm not poo-pooing it.
It could be said that, first of all, the idea of selling ourselves comes from an overarching capitalistic system in which you know money is of the most importance. But putting that aside, though. Within that worldview, if we're going to accept that worldview, I personally don't. But if we're going to accept that worldview, then how is it that in any other activity of our lives would that also apply? I mean, it seems like no matter what you're doing under that worldview, you're always trying to sell yourself. And isn't that kind of a pitiful way of looking at things?
It's realistic
explain why it's realistic.
You know, it's really in different ways of looking at it because, you know, when you come from the angle like art is good and commercial, you know, capitalism is bad,
right?
Then I'm ready to call you on your shit because
okay.
you're being hypocritical.
Call me on my shit. Why? But tell me why that's an inaccurate situation.
If you know that, if you're well aware that, you know, no matter what you're selling, if it's art, if it's an idea, you know, you're always, it's the, you know, as humans, we're always selling to each other and to bring that idea across. You know, you make
To me, if I would make, to me, the expression itself in art should be whatever is being quote unquote sold. Really, what I find art is able to do is make something exceptionally compelling in which people are both able to appreciate it with money and without.
Yeah, yeah. It goes back to storytelling. Right. Like before, people were making art and were just like recounting events, whether it actually happened or not.
Right.
It's over time has gotten more complicated. You know, we have books now that tell stories, and then we have TVs and movies. And,
oh, but see, TV, there's the story component, and there's also the programming part, which is called television programming, I feel, for a reason, but that's another issue to debate, but we're talking about
it. Yeah, yeah. It's amazing how many, how long we're able to rehash the same storytelling idea in a new, different medium.
Right.
And repackage it, and, you know, someone might have the audacity to say that this is something brand new. And,
right. Well, to me, any sort of form of expression, whether it be story time with stories, we were just talking about storytelling. But, it's the way of being able to express something. Now, stories are an awesome, like fables and such, they're an awesome collection, a codex of lessons that it seems like we continually need to remind ourselves of, which we can, because it's recorded. It's how we distribute our memory in one way, at least.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, to the audience, John, he just pointed at the portable microphone, an indication of it. It's pretty amazing, and I would have to agree.
Yep.
So, would you like to state your name?
Terry Dunham.
Terry Dunham. Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah.
And this is 98.5 KHAC, Merge Radio. Merge Radio is a Hearts and Crimes production produced locally here in Eugene, Oregon, by yours truly, Argus. Merge Radio is created for the enlightenment of all beings, to start important conversations, and to disseminate vital information across the greater Eugene area. Do not taunt Merge Radio. For immediate effect, apply Merge Radio liberally unto the inflamed parts of your hearts, minds, and pineal glands.
Hey Eugene, I said, hey Eugene, you're listening to 98.5. KHAC Merge Radio.
So, Eugene, I'm standing out here in front of the Horsehead Bar. Could you, standing here with Damien, what would you consider your position to be?
Bouncer.
You're a bouncer. And
doorman/bouncer.
And it's interesting, my friend and I, there are four people here. I'm here with Helen Being, DJ Mary Jane, and another gentleman. And my friend, he didn't have his ID on. He's over 40, but he didn't have his ID on him, and he was not allowed to come into the bar. Now, this is normally taken as a par for the course.
42.
I'm here just to this opportunity arose to investigate an organization called
OLCC.
The OLCC. Could you tell me what that acronym stands for and what they do?
It's the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. They run liquor licenses and enforcement of the laws as they regard to liquor.
Okay. And we were talking briefly before the interview started about the corruption involved in the OLCC. Could you tell me what the criteria for stopping and asking someone for ID is and why it's done?
Legally, I believe it's anybody who looks under 28 needs to have their ID checked before they come in the bar.
Okay.
Just to cover asses, we go by 30.
Go by 30. Now, I've noticed that. Have you tonight at all seen someone who looks over 30 and not asked them for an ID?
Yeah.
Okay.
If I see a lot of gray hair and wrinkles, I generally will assume that.
So gray hair and wrinkles
well
tells me more like 50.
Yeah. Well, if you look like you could be under 30 is the key thing.
Could be interesting. And is that what does the law say again? That you understand of the law?
Well, if you look under 28.
Right. And then what are the possible repercussions?
A large fine for the head bartender, mm-hmm. who's on staff. I don't actually get the fine, but right. you know, I want to protect my coworkers.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
and a large fine for the business, an even larger fine. In fact, right. I don't know the exact dollar amounts on it.
Right.
And then if you get too many incidents, you can lose your liquor license and the bar will be shut down.
Right. So the OLCC is the
yo,
body.
Yo. Gibby.
You can give it him. That's fine.
So the OLCC, to clarify, is the body that regulates the distribution of liquor licenses. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And the reason why we're looking at and examining this issue, dear listeners, is to reiterate, in order to come to a bar and drink alcohol, you need an identification issued to you by the Department of Transportation. And I would like to say, Damien, what are some of the other issues with the OLCC? A gentleman just passed us and said, well, you're going to find out a lot of shit about the OLCC. What kind of stuff was he talking about?
For instance, the fact that you can't buy beer after 2:30, that's OLCC regulation. Not being able to buy liquor anywhere other than a liquor store in Oregon, that's also part of the OLCC. You know, they dole out fines, they run stings. Generally speaking, when they run stings, they'll in the span of about a month, they'll go around to all the businesses in a given area.
So have you actually seen it or seen a sting take place?
I used to work at Circle K, honestly, and I had a couple stings run on me.
Right.
And
what do they do?
They just come in. Somebody anywhere between 18 and 30 will come in, mm-hmm. and try and purchase alcohol or cigarettes, depending on the kind of sting that they're doing.
On the payroll of the OLCC.
It depends. Some businesses hire an outside organization to come in and do these things themselves, so right. they can essentially do quality control,
right.
And make sure that those businesses are operating within the law,
right.
to prevent an actual sting from happening from the police.
And how does working under these laws make you feel?
It's why I'm here. It's why I get paid.
Right.
I'd rather be safe than sorry.
Right.
And I work security already. I'm right. used to people thinking I'm an asshole.
Right.
So
right.
you kind of get over it after a while.
You get over it. So you're comfortable with that. Oh, look at this! Is that motorcycle? This is tremendous. And so, would there be, if you didn't have to do ID checking on cars? Would there be anything else for you as a bouncer to do?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's general security. Somebody gets out of line, somebody has too many drinks and refuses to leave.
Right.
Honestly, most of my job is talking to people and trying to be charismatic. You know, like, I'm the greeter, essentially. Okay. You're good. You're good. Good. I don't know. It's a customer service job more than anything else.
Right. So, to clarify, your job isn't actually dependent upon the OLCC. It's just it's an aspect.
No. But for various other purposes,
right.
it's what I do is very heavily in control
right.
by the OLCC.
Okay.
And there's an interesting little. Let me get these guys.
Yeah.
What is that?
This is a microphone.
But it's like this big.
Yeah, it's great.
That's badass.
Technology.
Where does it really get to?
Digital files, waves, or MP3s.
That's fucking cool.
Yeah.
Welcome, guys. There's this tricky little legal mambo that happens where, according to the OLCC, no one in here is drunk.
Wait, say it again?
If somebody is drunk,
yeah.
they cannot be served, and they cannot be in a bar.
Ah, so what is the definition of drunk, then, according to the OLCC?
Intoxicated, visibly intoxicated.
Visibly, so it's very qualitative as opposed to quantitative. They're not
exactly.
Coming in
well, I mean,
blood level.
Yeah, no, I mean, that. You know, the OLCC isn't going to come in here and start giving breathalyzers.
Right.
But, So that's the one side of it. And then on the other side of it, according to the insurance companies, that, you know, and every bar needs to be insured heavily, generally, everyone here is drunk, as far as, like, safety issues.
So, as far as safety issues are concerned.
By
two different definitions of drunk, people are simultaneously both drunk and not drunk at a bar.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
It's the tricky legal framework that
right
that runs bars.
All right. I have not. Merge Radio is a Hearts and Crimes production produced locally here in Eugene, Oregon, by yours truly, Argus. Merge Radio is created for the enlightenment of all beings, to start important conversations, and to disseminate vital information across the greater Eugene area.
You're listening to Merge Radio with Argus, 98.5 KHAC.
Hello, Eugene. This is your sign-off, Argus, in the flesh, here at Hearts and Crimes Studios, 98.5 KHAC. I want to thank everyone who interviewed with me this week. Ezra, the Bookmobile, Gene Stacy of Eugene Sleeps, as well as the fabulous musicians who just grace Eugene with their street performances. And I would like to say that anytime you see a street musician performing, just stay by and listen. You don't have to give them money. I mean, you might listen to your heart on that one. But listen. Listen to what they're telling you. I am constantly amazed by Eugene and look forward to exploring together what Eugene has to offer. Thank y'all. Have a good night. Go in peace.